This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
This parallels my life as a chef, too, because I am not trained and I did not work for anyone else. When I wanted to learn about cooking and food and having restaurants, I learned by doing. Mm-hmm. I went and opened some shit, and actually it failed, and then I had to start over again.
Right.
But that was also a great lesson. And so I think with flowers, it's like I'm just a hands-on person. I'm not going to go to florist school, and I'm not going to go get a mentorship with another florist that I respect. I guess I'm just going to go out and do it and see mm-hmm. what sticks and see what the community wants, and then make it or not make it or change it into something else.
And so far?
I love it.
That is Chef Naomi Pomeroy of Portland, Oregon.
They were surprised that I wanted to spend 50% of the recipes on appetizers, which are called mezze, and won them over with talking about the culture of sharing. And they totally understood, and they said, you know what? This is not normal for us, but it makes total sense for this book. Yeah. We'll back you on that. And so they did. And then I told them, I said, we're going to do your typical vegetarian seafood and meat appetizers, and the same thing with the entrees. I said, but there's, you know, in my heart, in my heritage and everything that I'm about, you know, we've got to have a chapter on octopus so that people can learn how to cook it. All my relatives cook it in Greece. Yeah. It's like cooking, you know, chicken or right. steak.
And that is Chef Pano Karatasis of Kima in Atlanta, Georgia, our guest on a special doubleheader episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. And as you have probably heard on a recent episode, and you may have noticed if you subscribe to the show, a proliferation of episodes happening at a greater rate than the usual once per week, I am trying to post a serious backlog of episodes. I'm trying the patience of the engineers at Heritage, who already have a lot of work to do. I'm trying the patience of guests, some of whom gave me interviews as far back as August. But, you know, I can't say no when I'm presented with an opportunity to interview somebody who doesn't live in New York and is visiting and who I think might be interesting to all of you or just to me selfishly. I can't say no to a chance opportunity to interview somebody fascinating when I'm on the road, which is why I always travel with my podcasting gear. And I can't say no to people I've wanted to have on for the longest time, and we finally were able to work it into the schedule. So that's why we have this backlog. Today, I'm posting not the first one we've done, but the first one in a while, a double feature. There will be more in the coming days and weeks as I try to catch up and get all these interviews out to you guys. But today's great. I, first of all, have for you Naomi Pomeroy. Naomi, as many of you probably know, is the chef of Beast Restaurant in Portland, Oregon. She also has across the street from Beast a really cool bar called Expatriate. I was in Portland in September with the crew from Heritage Radio Network. We were doing podcasts as part of the Feast Portland Festival. Those interviews, by the way, are available, many of them, on the Heritage Radio Network website. Some of them have been incorporated into episodes of the show Meat and Three, which is a show done by some of my colleagues here at the network. Naomi and I met my first day in town. It was a chance meeting. The Heritage crew was at lunch. Naomi knew some of the people at the table. We had never met before. I introduced myself. And then I quietly pulled her aside and said, hey, could I hit you up for a podcast interview? She was very receptive. And we met, so I have to say, in addition to her restaurant and in addition to her bar. And in addition to a book she wrote, by the way, which is wonderful, called Taste and Technique, which was written in collaboration with a friend of mine here in New York, Jamie Feldmar, a writer who I like a lot, Naomi has opened a flower shop in Portland called Colibri. Now, why is a chef opening a flower shop? Well, we'll get into that in this interview. And we actually met at the flower shop. So this was a rather spontaneous interview during a hectic time in Portland when this festival was going on. Naomi and I first connected, as you'll hear, in the morning at the flower shop, but we had a bit of a pile up of commitments for her. Someone had scheduled something else for her before we could get through our whole interview. So I returned in the afternoon when it was warm enough to sit outside and finish the interview out back. And this is kind of a no-agenda interview, a getting-to-know-you interview, a free-flowing interview with a great conversationalist. It's basically two people shooting the breeze, talking shop on a Saturday in the Pacific Northwest, which I enjoyed quite a bit, and I hope you do too. And that is all I am going to say about it. So here you go. My interview with Chef Naomi Pomeroy, recorded at Colibri Flower Shop in Portland, Oregon. Here you go. So we're sitting here. It is a Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon, which is a great thing.
It's great. Saturday is great.
Right? Here. I don't know. I used to spend a lot of time out here, and I always think of like stuff that I only saw in the movies before that, like spontaneously hanging out on someone's porch, you know, and drinking some beers. And like that happens here.
It totally does.
In the Pacific
does.
Northwest.
Yep.
I mean, you're working, but... Anyway, we may or may not have a short interview. You have some other commitments happening. We're going to try to pick up after the other commitments, but we might not. So
true.
If this becomes a short take for the show, that'll be why. Anyway, we are here. How do I properly pronounce the name of this shop?
Colibri.
Colibri.
Yeah, it means hummingbird in Latin.
Which I have read is your spirit animal.
Whoa,
is that true?
You read that, yeah.
Yes.
Great. Thanks for doing your research. It is
research
my spirit
here.
Animal.
I do my own research. I don't need to have a producer. Tell me about that.
I think it's going to sound like a real Portlandia kind of moment, but you were already talking about the Saturday morning beer drinking on the porch vibe, so I'll just follow that up with a little bit more hippie stuff for
Please.
You. I've been in my life, like, you know, faced with some difficult decisions. I mean, as we all are. And, a few of those times I noticed that when I was trying to think like, oh, I'm not sure what to do. And then I had come to a conclusion like, okay, you know, I'm going to let this person go and it's going to be okay. Or, you know, something significant. And they're, when it's the right decision, the hummingbird shows up. It was just sort of like
really weird.
Like,
this is a theme in your life.
A theme in my life
really?
Is challenging decision, not quite sure, make the choice, and then the hummingbird seems to visit to tell me it was like the right direction.
Do you remember the first? I mean, does this go back to childhood?
No, it doesn't go back to childhood. It does go back to like this sort of difficult thing that happened where I needed to part ways with someone in business.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like not the easiest choice to make. And it was, you know, I was weighing all my options and then I had kind of decided and I was actually walking into work from my house and I thought, oh God, I just don't know. I was still conflicted. Am I doing it right? Is this the right thing? And then a hummingbird sort of showed up and flew, you know, right, like in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like in a make sure you pay attention to me way. Like I've never been approached by a hummingbird that sort of like paused in the air sort of next to me as
yes.
I was walking.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah. I never have.
No. So, and then subsequently it's happened several other times.
So the first time it happened, it just seemed like, why is this hummingbird doing that?
It and then felt like a message though.
It did.
Oh, like 100%. I was like, oh my God, this is a sign. Like, and you know, people make that shit up. I don't know. Is it a sign?
Well, are you
Who cares?
Spiritual by nature or
Not
is this
at all.
An exception to your usual view of the world?
Yeah, it's kind of an exception. I'm super I lived in India for a while and actually I was just recalling with my dad the other day, he said he'd given his end of life directives, you know,
yes.
to all the kids.
Yes.
Okay. That could be really depressing.
Yes.
But I open up my email and it's like, I mean, he's 70, he's in good health. We're very lucky. But you know, he's writing like about whether they want, you know, feeding tube or
yes.
keeping the life going.
No heroic measures is the term that seems to come up.
And he wrote I just want to be as comfortable as possible. And then smiley face. So I don't know anybody that has a smiley face on their end of life directive,
wow.
But I think it's really emblematic. And I wrote back this email to my whole family and I said, well, this is pretty, you know, on for the course. Like it's pretty on par, like with dad and his perspective on death, because, you know, as a kid, I said, what happens when you die? And he said, like, I was 4 or 5 when kids start asking those questions. Yeah. And he was just like, well, you go into the earth and you come back and your soul returns to make another cycle and try to improve on what you did in the life before. I mean, he grew up in India also, you know, for uh-huh. a while. And I lived there for about a year when I was 20.
So is this what philosophy is this? Is this a Buddhist philosophy?
I mean, it's, dude, I don't know. It's okay. I think it's just like sort of a natural, you know, people try to be their best selves in this life and yeah. then maybe come back to fix the shit they didn't do mm-hmm. right.
Yeah.
Can I say shit on the show?
You can say anything. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Anything. I always tell people they can say anything and then nothing really exceptional happens.
Really? Yeah. I'll try really
Everyone
hard
always
to
seems really happy. Everyone always seems really happy about it and then it doesn't. It's like, oh, there's a one-off and then we move on.
I'm pretty sure I dropped an F-bomb. In fact, I know I dropped an F-bomb in my TED Talk. And so it's been an issue since then.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were they pissed?
Not pissed, but it may have been bleeped out. I don't know because I never watched the talk because I don't like watching myself on shows.
Really?
Uh-uh.
Okay. Because why? Because you think you could have done better or you just feel self-conscious?
Yeah, it's more just like I think as humans, like I think chefs in particular tend to be kind of, you know, overly critical of themselves in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like I try to quiet those voices, not increase them.
Yeah.
And I tend to find that if I do spend too much time looking at myself on TV or listening to myself, it's like I it's endless, the judgments.
Do you like doing this though?
Well, here's the thing. I love, first of all, public speaking. Yeah. If I could be anything other than a chef, just get paid to talk to
just
the public.
Just not filmed.
I love being filmed. I just don't personally like watching it.
Okay.
I think I'm good at it. People love it. There's like very, seems to be like people really relate to me on TV and they're into it. And I love the process of making it.
Mm-hmm.
I love being with other people mm-hmm. and like kind of being creative and expressing myself. But I personally don't want to watch it.
Right.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, I've always been, and I've done some, like I've judged on, most recently, you know, I've been on Bobby Flay's show a couple of times. I've actually shot a sizzle reel for a show someone's trying to develop. But I love doing this. Like from the first time I ever promoted a book and got to go on radio when it was just radio.
Yeah.
And then podcasting, I love not worrying about where my arms are. I love not worrying about what I'm wearing.
Yeah.
I love not worrying about if my hair behaved that
day. Mine's kind of the double chin thing. It's just like a theme, you know? I have so many pictures of me on the internet where I'm like looking down chopping something.
And
it's just
right.
like, you know, that's never a flattering angle for anyone.
Yes.
And in the beginning of Beast, you know, I used to, you know, Beast was opened in 2007. And I think the rise of the social media was happening like really right in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, it was like MySpace was ending. Like it had only been like maybe a couple years of Facebook.
Blogs were peaking.
It was so ridiculous because, you know, I was so unprepared for the fact that everyone would come in and want to take photographs mm-hmm. of the food of mm-hmm. me. And in the first year or two, I actually used to make the servers go up to people and say, if you'd like to take a posed photograph with Chef Pomeroy, she would be okay with doing that. But no candid shots of her while she's working.
Really?
Because I was so upset at the sort of number of photographs that I found displeasing that were on the internet. But then I think I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm not actually, you know, I'm not actually a famous person. One, I'm not certainly not rich enough to pay someone to scrub the internet of unsavory images. Mm-hmm. So I just went with it. After
Do you not
a while.
Consider yourself a famous person?
Well, I like minor, like super minor leagues famous. I really don't. It's like my least favorite part of what I do. Like I love being with people and talking mm-hmm. and maybe part of their interest in talking to me comes from some sort of celebrity something or other. But ever even saying that makes me feel really uncomfortable. Yeah. I just am not – I've never been into that part of it. But yeah. I also accept – I think in this day and age, chefs make big mistakes sometimes when they don't do that, when they – I this is just a personal opinion of mine that like in this day and age, like I know some restaurants that have shut down, you know, that have been really, 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 really good restaurants. Yeah. And the conversation that I've had with other people about it is like, listen, I hate to break it down this way, but I think that happened because that guy just wanted to cook great food and that's all he wanted to do.
And either thought they were above the plate at what Bill, my friend Bill Telepan calls playing the game.
Yeah, you know? You gotta do
but
it.
You, I've, so I had a book out this year called, do you know about my
I
book?
I know.
Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Yes.
And so I did a lot of interviews and that part of what happens in the book is chefs kind of start to become famous, right? So I got asked a lot of questions about
this. I can't
this.
Wait to read it, honestly. I saw the thing come out and I've started following you on Instagram because of it. And I don't have the book yet. Maybe
I'm gonna
have
send
a copy.
You one. Okay. I almost threw some in my bag and now I'm worried that I did. Now
that shit is heavy.
Wish I had. Yeah, well, it is. It's still in hardcover. But what I was going to say was, so I've been asked a lot of questions about celebrity, right? And chefs. And a lot of answers have developed for me sort of over the course of like touring around promoting the book. But one of the things I've said about the current scene is that I feel like if you are a chef and you are in a position to be known, whatever that means, right? I don't like the term celebrity chef. I use the word famous or known, you know.
Known I like. I'm going to start using that.
I think celebrity chef is too much. I don't believe in that. It is a category, but I think any working chef doesn't belong in that category.
It's true. It's sort of like only reserved for people who like, I don't know.
Who are only on TV and doing public appearances.
Have a bobblehead shape in someone's car.
Or that. What I said was, if you're in a position to have that it was fiscally irresponsible not to. That 100%. I did not think it was viable, even in a market like Portland, right? Where there's so many restaurants. Like, you know, the idea that you can go on Eater and see, you know, 20 new restaurants you need to try this fall, right?
20 new restaurants you need to try this week,
right.
Andrew.
But if that's the world... You need to stay in the public eye, right? You're nodding. Yeah.
It's fucking insane.
I just don't think people can afford the luxury of being above that or looking down on it or thinking that's not why they got into it. I think it's like the cost of doing business.
I had a fantastic conversation with my chef de cuisine about this mm-hmm. because, you know, he is really just a magical person. Like I really got the partnership of the dreams, you know, and it'll be probably his last round before, you know, maybe we try to open a restaurant for him together or, you know, like who knows what the future holds, but I'm very happy. But it was funny because in the beginning, our only source of conflict really was that, you know, I would come in and, you know, he started writing the menus and like submitting them to me. And I backed down as like almost like more of an editor role at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I've learned in like the 22 years of being in business is that, restaurants, I think a small restaurant like mine operates much better with people, you know, fulfilling their own fantasies and dreams instead of just the chefs. I mean, mm-hmm. if you don't give them any creativity, they won't stay. So, right. You know, that's anyway, you know, I remember we had this one argument that was like, well, listen, I said the food is, it tastes incredible. Everything is really on point, but the entrees have been pretty brown recently. And I know that meat and delicious sauce and, you know, a cooked vegetable often has a brown situation going on. But I need an Instagram-worthy entree next week. And he was like, he just looked at me like, what the fuck? Like, what? Like, right. just
That's
like,
not rock and roll, man.
That was so offensive.
That's not why we started this.
No. And it's like, and the theory and the idea of just making really incredible stuff and just, oh, yep. And I said, what kind of restaurant do you want to open when you open a restaurant? And he was like, I want to open like a little neighborhood place. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to be like me cooking. And, you know, I'm not going to like, because people get irritated. Sometimes my staff is like, why are we doing another fucking event? Like, like, we just want to cook good food, and you know, it's sacrificing this and sacrificing that. Like, and I'm, guys, no. And so finally, what was so funny is he made an Instagram worthy entree. And I mean, mind you, I don't do that superfluous shit. Like, you can't just, you know, put red peppers on it because they're colorful. And,
right.
So it has to be like the entirety of the thing is conceptualized as a whole, but with the image of the food as part of the what you're talking about, the execution. And it was something sexy as hell. I think it was like this pork belly. I think that it's actually on my Instagram. And it was this pork belly with this like delicious succotash and, you know, very, very beautiful, bright colors. And it ended up getting like three times as many likes as like the average photo does on my Instagram feed. And I made sure to take that back to him. And I said, look, man, this got, look at this, like 800 likes or whatever. And he said, God, I'm so irritated that this is true, but you're right. And I've learned so much, like, going into this now, if I'm going to do my own thing, I have to do that.
Yeah. Is this person younger than you are?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, see, this is fascinating to me, because this is kind of the inverse of the usual template. Well, like, this conversation would usually be going the other way.
Right, like, right? I'm an old fogey at 43.
No, I don't mean, you know what I mean.
It's true, and I, like, it's so weird. This year was the first year that I had two people for the Star Chefs Congress that happened here in Portland, like, say that I was, like, their mentor. And I was like,
did that weird you out?
Ooh.
Yeah.
I had to like go to my therapist. I'm like, am I old enough to be someone's mentor? This is really stressful. I was so used to being like the young person, you know?
And someone last night said, I went up to someone who had turned out knew an old friend of mine from Seattle.
Uh-huh.
Or they're related, actually. I went up to this very young chef, and I said, hey, and I said, my name's, you know, so-and-so. And he goes, oh, it's an honor to meet you, which is about the nicest thing someone could say, but it also weirded me out.
You're like, who am I?
Yeah, exactly.
What does that even mean?
I mean, it's incredibly
I feel like
flattering.
You're calling me old right now,
exactly.
Kid.
It feels like something that I said to, like, you know, I don't want to name names, but people I've met in my life.
Totally.
Who, you know, in any event. So let me ask you the flip side of this, though. Do you ever have anxiety brought about by the social media phenomenon? I've had a couple of chefs on the show.
Is that a rhetorical question? Like, I mean, you mean that as you're actually curious whether I do or I don't? Do you know anyone that doesn't?
Well, it's only come up for me recently, but a couple of chefs I've interviewed on this show have said it's the inverse of what, or the dark side of what you're describing, right? That a dish, either that they would put a dish up on their social media, or a customer would put something up that they didn't like, or that they thought was, you know, didn't look pretty or whatever, and that it would maybe not go viral, but, you know, there's, you know, hundreds of people would see that.
Yeah.
And, like, that people told me it was inhibiting them.
Interesting. Well, I wouldn't argue with that, but that part of it doesn't really keep me up at night. Like, I've definitely come to realize that. I think, you know, not to toot my own horn too much, but I think I'm pretty good at the food photography part of things. Like, I think my Instagram feed looks really good. Uh-huh. And so I don't worry about that. And as far as the other controlling what else is out there, that kind of goes back to the idea of like trying to pay someone to scrub the images of me with a double chin off the internet that have been on there since, you know, 2007 or whatever. So I kind of feel like I got over other people not being good at food photographs and realizing that it's fine. I meant, does it cause me social, like, does it cause me anxiety? Like 100%. Like, one thing that happened to us this week is that there's just nothing new under the sun. And we made this dish that was like Dungeness crab and heirloom tomatoes and like all this stuff that's really like about to disappear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like I called my Instagram this week, last chance summer dance, because it's like, this is the end. Yeah. And, but you know, it just turns out that like the French Laundry has a salad right now with crab and heirloom, you know, and I just like, and even the plate up was kind of similar. And I was like, oh man, like, I didn't look at social media before I designed this dish, but maybe this is like gonna, somebody else might see this and think that I stole it from someone else.
Right.
I mean, I definitely don't really truly worry about that, but yeah. If the thought crosses my mind, I think I have more like a FOMO stuff with the social media, mm-hmm,
totally.
You know, where I'm like, Dominique Crenn like did this dinner with Rezzy and it was all female chefs and I'm friends with her and you know, like how come I didn't get invited,
yeah.
You know? And like, it's just so fucked up because you know, everyone knows that you can't invite everyone
to everything.
It doesn't,
yeah.
It doesn't matter, but it's like, I think it does cause us to compare ourselves to other people in just the weirdest yeah. ways.
Well, it stops us off from getting past high school.
Right?
Right.
Seems like
basically.
That must be intentional. They're just going to keep us down forever.
Well, I have two 14-year-old kids at home, right?
Yeah.
And we have a lot in common socially,
dude,
you know?
Like, I know.
We can relate to moments that, like, you know, they'll be on a thing like, why wasn't I invited to this party, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then I'm looking at some event going like, why am I not at this opening? You
yes.
know, except I'm 40 years older than
yeah.
they are.
Yeah.
You
well,
know, it's a little pathetic in
it
a way.
Is. Well, yes, but, you
but
know.
It can also be fun.
It's a little bit of both.
So can we talk about where we're sitting right now?
Yes,
why did you open, I'm just going to throw it out there very broadly, why did you open a flower shop? Which is, by the way, the space is, it's great. I mean,
yeah.
It's got a very warm feeling. But tell me why you did it first, then I'd love to talk about how you
sure.
put it together.
Okay, yeah. So I opened a flower shop. It was, I like to say that it's sort of an accidental flower shop.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long kind of protracted story, and I'll keep it short, but it's essentially it's just sort of, I'm rather resourceful and my husband is a big dreamer and he's very creative. Have you been to my cocktail bar, Expatriate?
I haven't.
Well, Andrew, get your ass over
there,
buddy. Yeah, it's amazing. And it has similar vibes.
I haven't been to Portland in 20 years.
Oh, you're
in my
forgiven.
Defense, in
okay,
my
that's a super great defense, actually. Make sure to get the hamburger. Everyone says it's the
okay.
best. So I do the food over there too. And he kind of, and people say, cause he was a bartender and he opened mm-hmm. it as a bartender. And people sort of say, well, now that Kyle's not bartending, what does he do? And I'll just tell you what he does. And it's like, he's a curator of like experience, you know, doesn't that sound like so sort of ethereal, but
yeah.
when you walk into Expat later, you'll realize what I'm talking about. Sort of like looks like this dark opium den. And we only, there's no screens and there's no internet in there.
Right.
And you're not like allowed to use your phone. I mean, somebody tries to use their phone, of course, every day, but it's like dark and there's only vinyl.
Uh-huh.
And all the checks are written in hand, like, you know,
that.
By hand.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, maybe we're just like sort of Luddites or old fogey people, you know, but I think that the age of like, I don't know, like Amazon and like all the ways that people are just like do their entire lives online. And like some people mm-hmm. in Japan haven't left their house in 5 years and, you know.
But you're describing, sorry to interrupt if I may.
No, it's
but
fine.
You, what you're describing is to me this sort of, I don't know, we used the word spirit before, right? But
oh,
there
yeah.
is this periodic thing that comes up and it's often dovetailed with food movements in this country. You know, if you go back to like Berkeley, right, in the
oh,
70s,
yeah.
there was this whole, but part of what was going on is really around this country at that time when people were starting to cook and be into food. But part of what that was all about was it was a reaction to sort of industrialized food and
yes.
TV dinners and,
yes.
and that people were searching for quote unquote authenticity. Right. But then you go to like right now and you go to a place like Brooklyn where I lived until recently and there's
mm-hmm.
the whole, all these people making their, you know, all the artisan stuff. And I think
yeah.
it's like you're,
well, we're trying.
What I think back then was a reaction to like the industrialized food and all of that. Is now sort of a reaction to, like you said, the tech era, right?
Yeah,
that
for
you're looking
sure.
for authenticity. You're looking for things that are tactile.
Yeah,
you're looking, right. Does
I
that
don't
make
want.
Sense?
Yeah, I don't want plastic stuff. You know, and
right.
I think you're absolutely right. It's just I was shaking my head so much when you were saying that and trying not to interrupt you because I talk about this all the time when people ask me about Oregon and Portland and why is it the way that it is? And my argument stems from my childhood and exactly what you're talking about. Like I'm a chef literally because my mom grew up in Southern California and her mom was like really thought about how skinny she should be and ate. Hold on a second. I have to check and see if there's somebody in
somebody
here.
Somebody just walked in.
Oh,
yeah.
Hi. Somebody just walked
in. We may or may not be back.
Well, I think we're going to be back. I'm just going to do my job for one second.
We are back. It's hours later.
Yes.
And we are now outside. I will never lie to you, listeners. We are outside in the back of the shop.
Yeah.
Is this the event? The shop says it has an event space. Is this the event space, or is the shop the event space?
I mean, the shop tends to be the event space only because Portland is not the weather friendliest city.
That's
as
true.
You may have noticed,
yes,
since your visit started here in a mud bath.
Yeah.
And so we don't have it really built out to be an outdoor facility, mm-hmm, for events. But as you notice, I have a little barbecue set up over there.
This is how observant I am. I noticed when I was here the first time today that there's also a grill behind me. I don't even need to look. You have two grills.
Yeah. Actually, that's my neighbor's grill. So there is a house that butts up right next to our property.
Wow.
And that's
and
Annie's
no
house.
Fence between the
and
backyards.
No fence. Look, you know,
that's
Portland,
great.
A city without fences.
That's so great. That is great. Don't you
actually
think?
And actually just that phrase, I love it.
Yeah.
Portland, a city without fences.
Okay. So when we stopped, we were about to start talking in earnest about the shop.
Yeah.
Tell me about the shop.
I'm going to ask you about the shop. Do you know very many chefs that do things that aren't chef related?
And from even another business?
Yeah.
Another business? No. Very few. I'm actually hard pressed to think of any.
Me too. And so what I realized, one thing I think, actually I was just talking to my friend Fabs that has Wild Air and Contra.
Love them. Yeah.
Oh my God. He's just one salt of the earth, one of my favorite people.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about that. We were talking about how sometimes as chefs, I think we have to do this thing where we just talk about food all the fucking time.
Full immersion.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Food all day, all night. What's your next meal going to be? And I'm thinking 10 steps ahead. And
yeah.
And I think maybe that's getting like, I'm ready to go away from that. I'm ready to talk about things other than food. Sorry, I hope that doesn't fuck up your podcast. But
no, I barely talk about food on this show. But, you know, the word balance comes up in chef interviews more now, mm-hmm, than it ever has probably any time in history.
Yeah, it was a foreign word before that people had never heard. And now I think in pursuit of that,
mm-hmm,
I figured I'm not quite ready to open another restaurant. Because, mm-hmm, I haven't found the right partners. I haven't found the right space. I don't know exactly what I would do yet. And it's sort of like I wrote a book 2 years ago.
Yes, you did.
Called Taste and Technique, and it's a really great book. And I was so proud of every single part of that book. It came directly from my innermost soul, and everything about it turned out exactly like I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kept thinking, wow, that was good. It was good money. It was a great thing. I'm so proud of it. And then I was thinking, what am I going to – I want to write another book. But you know what? The book isn't in there yet.
Yeah.
Like I can't just write another book because that's not me. I know some people are able to do that and they crank books out left and right.
Yeah, but those people or their managers or whoever look at the books as – I'll never forget the first time I was collaborating on something and the person's agent referred to it as the product. The book, right? And I'm like, product? Like, this is a personal thing. Like,
yeah.
What do you mean product? One of my favorite lines, I think it's in Scott Fitzgerald's notebooks. There's this book, mm-hmm, called The Crack Up.
Yeah.
Is you don't write because you want to say something. You write because you have something to say.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with that in mind, like not knowing... Like knowing, you know, I've been in this business now for about 20 years in some capacity or another. Mm-hmm. And I think of my career in 10-year chunks. The first part of it was just like struggling and working like 20-hour days and like running a catering company out of my basement and defrosting shrimp in the bathtub. And that was like a 10-year period of time that sort, mm-hmm, of then kind of evolved into restaurants and then Beast. And now I'm looking at this as like the I'm starting, you know, year 22 or whatever. And it feels like there's a next thing in me, but I haven't figured out exactly what that is. And so I feel like the flower shop is a way for me to press pause in a really, really healthy way that kind of like brings balance. And it really feeds a part of my soul that's like, it's textural, it's colorful. I mean, it's everything but flavorful. It's all the same stuff as mm-hmm. food. Flowers
are seasonal.
Have you
had botanistic tendencies?
Okay, in 2000...
I don't know if botanistic's a word, but...
Well,
has this been the
botanistic,
part, you've always had plants at home or a garden in the back? Or
I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon, which is a small college town. We had a huge garden in the back. My parents at one point actually ripped out the entire front yard, so we didn't have grass. We just had a garden.
Wow.
And a lot of flowers. And I like to steal flowers a lot from my neighbor's yards when I was a little kid. I was mm-hmm. an only child, like bored, and
yeah.
my projects were cooking projects and mm-hmm. flower arranging.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in 2009, when I got Best New Chef from Food & Wine magazine, part of my chef interview with Kate Crater, she asked all the chefs, you know, if you weren't a chef, what would you be? And my answer was botanist.
Interesting. So it's always been there.
Yeah, and I figured, and another thing is that, like, you know, we don't take it with us when we go. And I don't know what people are saving for. Like, I kind of have this weird thing, issue with people who, I'm sorry to all the listeners out there who have jobs that they hate and they punch the clock and everybody's working for the weekend. Great Loverboy song, but not great mm-hmm. if you're trying to live a life that feels very satisfying and awesome. And I don't want to say having a flower shop is something I'm going to do when I retire from being a chef. I don't want a project that I start when I'm 65.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do. I want a different project when I'm 65, but I hope it's just philanthropic and I can do something for charity or something like that. But for now I have to do something that feeds my spirit. And I don't think that the two are mutually exclusive, but I have had a really hard time thinking, are people going to judge me? I mean, you know, are people going to be like, oh, I guess she's not in the kitchen anymore? Or because do chefs just go on opening? I mean, look, top level chefs are not in their kitchens tons. And to everybody who thinks they're going to see the chef when
right.
they go in the kitchen, you know, the floor staff is trained to say, like, you know, she's in the basement, like, stocking vegetables or something. And
right.
really, she's, like, in the Bermuda or whatever.
Right.
So I think it's important for us to start to realize that chefs can't be everywhere all the time for every single need of all humanity. And we can't expect that of ourselves either. And so I am trying to train myself out of worrying what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lifelong process, and I don't think chefs are very good at that because we kind of have to care a little bit about what people think about us. Our businesses.
But was this a big consideration for you when you were? I mean, because this seemed not knowing you, just generically unexpected to me that a chef would open a flower shop. But it doesn't seem strange or odd, or it doesn't even really seem eccentric to me.
Okay.
It seems kind of cool that, like, you like this and you guys open this up.
Yeah, but people are like, oh, like, how do you do it all? Like, how are you, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's
right.
a lot of work, but it's like all my jobs that I do, all my hats, except for parenting, that actually feels like a lot of work. The other stuff is, you know, cooking. I just fucking love it.
Yeah.
Coming here to go to the flower market and arrange beautiful arrangements for people that to be in their shops or their restaurants or to give to their wives for their anniversaries. I mean, what joy.
Yeah.
So it's like not a bother.
Yeah.
If I'm going to spend 18 hours a day doing something, I'd like it to all be stuff that I really like.
So a couple of quick rapid fire questions for this. And then I want to talk about the trappings of the store.
Yeah.
My friend Jimmy Bradley, do you guys know each other?
I don't think
chef
so.
Chef owner of the Red Cat in New York.
Mm-mm.
But Jimmy has this line that restaurateurs and florists are the only people who buy things that go bad and sell them for a living.
We're like idiots.
Like, but have you ever connected
idiots.
That? Have you ever made that connection yourself now
Andrew,
that you actually are a chef florist?
Andrew, when I started doing the numbers on this place,
yeah.
And so the evolution of Calibri is like at first it was just going to be a floral design studio.
Yeah.
And then it was like every single person that I asked or gave free arrangements to hope that they would put like $100 arrangements in their businesses twice a week were like, we don't have a budget for flowers. So I realized quickly that it was a luxury item. And then I started doing the math, because that's what chefs do. We calculate waste and we mm-hmm. calculate flower cost percentage, not food cost percentage. Mm-hmm. And I was like, shit, man, these arrangements need to be really expensive, because I have to throw away 20% of the product.
There you go.
And that's a lot of waste.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, it's shocking. And flowers, actually, people don't even understand how expensive they actually are. Like, I buy a rose for $2 and I have to sell it for $5. And people are like, a $5 rose? And it's like, but yeah, but that's what it has to cost, yeah. or I'm not making any money. Yeah. And so the shop has evolved now. I quickly realized that I have 3-day shelf life on everything in here. It's like, it's almost like I opened up a fish restaurant right. for flowers.
Right.
And that's why you don't see a lot of seafood restaurants, for all you listeners out there that wonder why you come to Oregon and not everything is seafood.
Right.
It's because it's perishable, incredibly perishable. So the shop has evolved to be more plant-based. So we have a lot of houseplants now.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I still pride myself on with it is that, and maybe this is a control freak thing that I should let go of a little bit, but I don't just call up a vendor and say, bring me some palms and some figs. Like, I drive out to the nursery in my truck and I go and pick out the stuff myself, because I want the fig that has like the cool arm that like reaches out to the mm-hmm. left and looks cool. You need
right.
me, you know? And I want plants that I don't see at other plant shops, and actually really like it. I like the hour long drive.
Mm-hmm.
I like walking in the nursery and talking to Jesse, the guy that runs it. I like, you know, seeing what's new and talking about like plant varietals and all that. And I'm learning a lot. And I think that's one of the biggest parts of it, is like, I'm not a botanist. And in a way, you know, it's funny, I'm just now thinking of this. This parallels my life as a chef, too, because I am not trained and I did not work for anyone else. When I wanted to learn about cooking and food and having restaurants, I learned by doing.
Mm-hmm.
I went and opened some shit, and actually it failed, and then I had to start over again.
Right.
But that was also a great lesson. And so I think with flowers, it's like, I'm just a hands-on person. I'm not going to go to florist school, and I'm not going to go get a mentorship with another florist that I respect. I guess I'm just going to go out and do it and see mm-hmm. what sticks, and see what the community wants, and then make it or not make it or change it into something else.
And so far?
I love it. It's great. It's yeah. not making money, but it's not losing money. So
okay.
it's great.
So that's okay.
It's a break-even situation,
foul.
And I
yeah.
freaking love
and
it.
And it's your business,
and
so
I'm getting
you can live
new
with that.
Accounts all the time. Like, just, you know, every couple of weeks I'm adding like some big accounts. So we're actually really on the super up and up trajectory. I feel it. Like, the shop gets busier every day. And but we've added some cool little elements to the front. I don't know if you noticed that, but like right when you walk in, we have this old, beautiful maple burl table. Did you see it?
No.
Okay. Weighs like 1,000
pounds. I'm very
pounds.
Non-observant for a writer.
Okay. But we'll go and look at it when we're done here outside. And it's this slab. It, actually, I was exaggerating, but I think it weighs more than like 500 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like an 8-inch thick Oregon maple burl slab table. And I have for sale some things that are specially curated, things that I have that I write about in my cookbook, like my chef stuff that I can't live without. So everyone always asks me, like, what chef knife should they get? It's like they ask every chef.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to buy my wife some knives for Christmas. What should I buy? And so the one knife that I use the most, I have the paring knife and the chef's knife available here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Ninox from the Corin makes it. It's a Japanese knife. And then I have French steel pans, some beautiful kitchen towels, and some goat hair pastry brushes from Japan.
Okay.
And so these are like the things that I feel like you can't just find at, you know, go down to Williams-Sonoma and pick that up.
Right.
And so I made a little table of that stuff. And then my husband's a bartender, and he made a little area where he's selling some cocktail shakers
awesome.
And stuff that he mm-hmm. he really values.
So that's great.
It's just kind of a
it's like
mixture
an outlet
of
for
things.
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
What's the
what does this place give you on a, I don't know, on a temperamental spirit? Like, you know, it could not be more different when I met you earlier today from coming into a kitchen that's ramping up, right? You were the only one here.
Mm-hmm.
It's dead quiet. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, you're not warming up ovens. It's you're surrounded by plants and flowers.
Mm-hmm.
What does that give you? That has to be like a, I'm imagining that must be some kind of a, like almost a, I don't want to be precious about it, but like a sanctuary for you, or a great sort of flip side to have to the restaurant life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
It's the best. It's so a sanctuary, like that I just kind of, I float in. And like I said, like even if I have to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, which I mean, most chefs would tell you that's not possible. But I mean, a few of them, you know, run every day at 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Those are very impressive people. But getting up and coming here is this true pleasure, and having quiet when the rest of your life is like everybody's problems and someone's quitting and someone's, you know, mom is sick and they have to go take, you know, it's just like constant, like running restaurants, because restaurants attract incredibly like dramatic people. Mm-hmm. With like challenges in their lives. And the mental health issue is real everywhere, but especially in restaurants. And I think coming here to this place where it's like you open the door and everything in it is beautiful. Like everything's alive and it's like taking an oxygen bath kind of. And then you can like burn a little. Sometimes I burn a little Palo Santo, which is like a wood.
Mm-hmm.
It smells delicious. And just look at the plants and kind of, you know, take a little. If they have a little dead leaf, I'll take it off and like take the flowers and like strip them of their leaves and start to think about how I want to put them together and what combinations. But I'm kind of alone when I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Until the shop opens.
Yeah.
And it just feels really good. It's, I guess it feels like a meditation.
I was going to ask if it was meditative. That's the exact
feels
word
like
I was going to ask about.
It's funny. Whenever anyone asks me, this is a common chef question, like, what's your favorite kitchen job? And I usually say picking parsley.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, it's just repetitive.
You can get lost in it.
You can get lost
in
it.
Yeah, I used to know a cook. Her favorite job was cutting chives every night right before service.
Yeah. It just feels good, and it's like a moment of silence and reflection. And, you know, one time when I was 20, I did a silent meditation retreat in Thailand.
For how long?
10 days.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I talk a lot.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people think, like, how the fuck could you ever do that? I can't picture you doing that. But it was, I'll tell you what, when we ended the meditation retreat, I cried that I was, and I felt almost like I didn't want to talk again. It was really surprising, even to myself, that I didn't even know that about me. But the quietness was so soothing.
Were you interacting with other people?
Yeah, but walking. And
walking.
Seeing. Observing.
But was there no effort to communicate?
Zero.
With gestures or anything?
Nothing.
You know what's funny? We just got a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, because I had a dog when I was a kid, and we had a dog before we had kids, and that dog died 5 years ago. So our kids are 14. They really wanted a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a dog. It has changed the entire energy of the house. I love spending time with this dog. And I'm convinced that part of that is that it's wordless, that's the magic of it. I don't know why I never put that together before.
Mm.
But it is this relationship completely based on energy.
Yep.
You know?
I think they all are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But words... It's weird for a writer to say this, but words can very often be the problem.
Oh, sure. Wow, that's really interesting.
I think the bigger the thing you're talking about, a lot of times, the more the language can trip you up.
Yeah, for sure.
I think
that's a beautiful close to our interview. Is that... What time is it?
That's not very subtle.
I have to go to lineup.
It's 4:30.
You know what?
It's like when my therapist leans forward. I'm like...
I have like an innate... Like that, I only have a couple of skills. Okay, I'm great at cooking. I think I'm great at floral arranging.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah.
And the last one is I'm excellent at knowing what time it is and
that's so funny.
And having I went to Montessori school as a little kid, and one of the activities that you do in Montessori school is you pour like water that's only halfway up of a tall container into another container that will be an appropriate size. It's just like activities for mm-hmm. kids. Volume estimation is like my superpower. Like if you say like how many gumballs in that gumball mm-hmm. machine kind of guesser, and I'm pretty good at it. So I knew that it was about time for me to head out and go to lineup, which we do every night at Beast at 4:45.
Yeah.
And you said it's 4:30.
I did.
It takes me 10 minutes to drive
yes,
there.
Yes, no, I was just laughing at the unsubtlety of your saying.
I think that's a great place to wrap up. Hey, man, I don't
you,
think anyone's
you
ever
think
accused
that could
me
fool
of being
a Corleone?
Subtle. No one okay. has ever accused me of being subtle.
This is great. Thanks for making the time.
I loved it.
And we'll see you again.
God, I hope so. Thanks, everybody. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a cannon bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Welcome back to the show. Our thanks to Naomi Pomeroy. And now we are going to get to the second part of our double feature this week, Chef Pano Keratasis. And Pano is the chef of Kima, which is probably the most acclaimed Greek seafood restaurant in the United States. He opened it in 2001. It is in Atlanta, Georgia. And Pano is also the corporate chef of Buckhead Life Restaurant Group. They have a number of restaurants in that area and also in South Florida. Pano trained under some of the best chefs, I'm not even going to just say in the country, I'm going to say in the world. He trained under Jean-Georges Van Gerichten. He trained under Eric Repair. He trained under Thomas Keller. He took all of that learning, applied it to the food of his own personal heritage in this restaurant, and he has now written a book. It was published by Rizzoli. It just came out recently. It is called Modern Greek Cooking, 100 Recipes for Mezze, Entrees, and Desserts. And I have to tell you, I had never met Pano before. If I'm really honest, I wasn't all that familiar with him. And I got an invitation to a media lunch. This is not an infrequent thing that happens when someone has a book coming out. The lunch was in the salon, which is the private rooms at Le Bernardin. And the food that Pano and his team put out, which represents what's in this book, was just extraordinary. It was kind of a revelation to me. And we talk about the book at length in this interview. We also talk about Pano's career and about how he got to this place where he takes the food of his upbringing, the food of his family, the food of his ancestors, applies, like I said, all this incredible formal technique to it, and has come up with his own very distinct style of Greek food, which he labels modern Greek cooking, which I think is a good, simple way to put it. The guy has great energy. He's very soulful. He's very mellow. He's very thoughtful, as one would be coming from the kitchens that he came up in. And I was just kind of impressed by him. I think you will be too. And that's all I'm going to say about it. This is my conversation with Pano Keratasis, recorded in September in New York City. Here you go. So we're here in New York, your old stomping grounds.
That's right.
You're here promoting a book.
Modern Greek Cooking.
Your first book.
Yes, it is.
So before we get into your sort of backstory, can you just tell me what has the experience of doing a book for the first time been like for you?
It's been extraordinary. First, you have to choose the concept of the book,
mm-hmm.
which I knew I wanted to do the food that I've known for in my restaurant.
Right.
Then I had to make sure that the recipes I chose were going to be recipes that people could do at home.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the stuff I do in the restaurant that people would have loved to have seen in the book didn't make it because the recipes were difficult. But the majority of the recipes that everybody comes to the restaurant for and love is in the book.
Okay.
So then I had to obviously get a photographer and a writer to do a sample.
You did photography as part of your proposal process.
I did.
That's unusual.
So I hired Jill Cohen, who has published books, written books, and she became my agent as well as somebody who is going to help me with this sample.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a producer.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So we looked at a choice of photographers, and I loved the work that Francesco Tonelli mm-hmm. was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my first choice. He was my only choice. And when I called him up, he said yes.
Uh-huh.
We connected over the phone, and then when he came in town doing the shoot,
yeah,
we really connected then.
Uh-huh.
And we've become friends ever since.
That's great. So you guys didn't know each other before?
No.
Oh, okay. You guys really have become friends. We'll talk about this more when we get more into the book later. But when I came to a media lunch yesterday, the day before we're doing this interview, at La Bernardin, which was very special. I mean, it was an amazing lunch. And he was there, and it seemed like you guys had a vibe like you had known each other forever. You're grinning as I say this.
Yes.
Like you're brightening
it's
as
true.
I say this.
It's true. You know, he's Italian.
Yeah.
I'm of Greek heritage.
Okay.
So we connected sort of in the old world sense.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we're both extremely passionate about food because yeah. Francesco is a chef in his own right.
Right.
And he trained in Italy, and he was an instructor at the Culinary Institute of America, and he's an incredible photographer.
Yeah.
So there's a great way to connect with him, you know, from a food standpoint. And this type of cuisine and the food that is in the book Modern Greek Cooking is the kind of food that I grew up with, and he sees similarities to what he grew up with.
Mm.
So to be able to put them in a presentation for this type of photography and work that we did,
yeah,
it kept it in its roots,
yeah,
and at the same time too, made for some extraordinary pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And what people are excited about back home in Atlanta, especially, is the fact that this is not only something that people want on their table and have one of their table books,
yeah.
Because of the pictures and how pretty the Francesco's work was, but that, you know, the recipes also are something that we focused on with Rizzoli,
sure.
The publisher.
Yeah, yeah.
So
can you just speak to I don't think we've ever talked about this on the show, but it's something I observe all the time. The way you just reacted when I mentioned Francesco, the relationship between chefs and photographers, specifically photographers who have shot them, is very special very often. I don't know if you've had other photographers in your life, but it's almost unlike anything I've ever seen, except maybe the way, actors or models sometimes connect with their photographers.
Sure.
Does that make sense when I say that? It's interesting. I feel like if a photographer shoots your food the way you want it to be seen, that just turbocharges the bond.
Yes.
Can you speak to that for a minute? Because I've seen this with a million chefs over the years who, like, when they finally get around to doing the book, they're like, I want either it's somebody they know or, in your case, somebody they've admired from afar.
Yeah.
And then they go and get – when I did Alfred Portale's first book, Gozen Kushida, who shot the book, who lived in Japan. But wow. Alfred had seen his work in, like, Japanese food magazines and, like, got somebody to get in touch who spoke Japanese and brought him over.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very interesting dynamic.
I think when I called Francesco up.
Yeah.
And I'm telling him I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm fascinated with his work. And he's listening to my story, my passion for Greek food.
Yeah.
And I think that's intriguing to him, if you think about it, making the trip to do this. And of course, with his research and learning about me and what I've been doing at Kima, and also coming from a restaurant family and having a father that is sort of a legend in the southeastern United mm-hmm. States of America, obviously that was intriguing too as well. So
yeah.
for him to want to come make that trip just goes ahead and is a sort of an example of somebody who's researching, recognizing my work, and feeling like he's going to be able to connect with it. On my end, I've worked with many photographers. And to your point, you know, there are times where you're working with a photographer who's not connecting with your food. So the food is personal. And the yeah. one thing that Francesco gets is that food is personal. So when you're working with some photographers that see a plate of food and they want to get too much into maybe the tableware, the glassware, the positioning.
Prop that, crazy.
That's your prop crazy. They don't mind that your food has lost its luster because they're going to spray it or they're going to change it in yeah. some form. You know, that's where all of a sudden the disconnect happens. And quite frankly, I don't want to work with somebody that's yeah. not connecting with the yeah. food because it's personal. Yeah. Francesco was extraordinary. If you see his work, and he's done some beautiful books, 11 Mads, one of my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up and he wants me to do all of my presentations.
Right.
And so I was thrilled about that because I wasn't sure how he worked, and I definitely wanted to do my own presentations, and we talked about that, and I wasn't looking for any sort of conflict. And so when he came in town, and here I am doing my own food styling,
mm-hmm.
it was amazing to see how he worked with that. And he asked me to make sure that when we were done, not asked me, he told me that when we're done, we would get to taste the food. So the food was real. That's the other part that's great.
Yeah, that's not, for people who are listening who don't know this, that is not always the case.
Extremely rare.
People use a lot of things to make food shine, to make sauces look thick, to keep something from melting.
That's on.
Very often there's, you know, there's like a backstage to a dish. Like there's toothpicks holding things up and things like that. You know, right?
It's like, true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
And so the best part, and I think the connection process that we had is, you know, we spend 3 days together in Atlanta doing a sample.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do another, you know, 3 days of shooting for the book.
Yeah.
And
that was it?
They were long days.
You did this whole book in 6 days?
I would like, yes.
That is shocking.
The preparation for it and the organization of it.
Well, yeah, sure. But I mean, still, this is not a book that has a couple of little color inserts. This is a beautiful, I'm not just blowing smoke. Sure. It is a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And to your point about his eye, the camera like caresses the food. I mean, there is this real sensual thing going on.
Because of our connection,
yeah.
There was no 8-hour day. We were working 12 hours each day.
Yeah.
And going over time.
Yeah.
I'm coming up with the recipes and the foods and bringing them out, and we're spending time making sure they're positioned right when I do the collages mm-hmm. or when it's just a solo shot.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, when it's all said and done, we were doing 8 to 9 photos a day within a 12-14 hour period.
Okay.
So it is realistic because the book has about 50 photos.
Yeah. But still, that's
it's still.
Congratulations.
You got to be.
My compliments.
You have to be organized. Let's put it that way. So I was definitely organized.
I want to talk more about the book, but first I want listeners to get to know your story. Okay.
Absolutely.
So you were born where?
I was born in Savannah, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and my parents were born in Savannah, Georgia,
okay.
and my grandparents were all born in Greece.
Okay. So you're second generation.
Second generation.
Okay. But you grew up not in Savannah, Georgia, or at least part
Correct.
Of your childhood was not in Savannah, Georgia.
Correct. I was born in Savannah shortly after my father had gotten a promotion to work in Lake Ozark, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was born in Savannah.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, raised in Lake of the Ozark with a sister, Anne, who is 2.5 years older than I am, okay. and my younger brother, Nico, who was born a year after we moved.
Wow. So you're the middle child?
Yes.
Okay. And what is a Missouri childhood? That's my best attempt to say Missouri correctly. Did I do okay?
Sure.
No?
Okay. Missouri, right?
Don't people say Missouri? They don't?
Probably some do, I guess.
Okay. Whenever I see people talk about political campaigns, they always bust people for saying Missouri when they're in Missouri. They always say that's a faux pas.
Right.
That's not true?
I don't know.
I got to send a note to Chris Matthews.
I was young. I was there. I was there from the time, you know, I was born until 8 years old.
Okay.
About seven.
So. Okay. But what was it like in Missouri? What was it like there?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because in the book, it's the shortest description of sort of like my life.
But it goes right by, yeah.
I write in there that my brother and I grew up like Tom Sawyer and Tarzan, little combination of living in the woods. We would wake up in the morning. We would pack a little bag. We would say bye to my mother, and we wouldn't return to the house until dinner time.
You would have adventures.
All day long.
A lot of imagination? Was there a lot of
All real. All real. So
you weren't like pretending you were, like when you said Lone Ranger, you guys weren't like role playing out there.
No.
You were just hiking and climbing.
Adventuring. When you're going through the hills of Missouri,
yeah.
And we were in Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri, there's little valleys everywhere. And the trees actually grow vines.
Okay.
And so we used
don't
to.
Tell me.
Oh yeah, we swing on the vines over the hills. I mean, we had our shirts off. We'd make it to a friend's house.
Yeah,
and our friends were always. Everybody lived a mile apart.
Yeah,
not a lot of homes on this 125-mile lake.
Yeah,
full of trees, full of woods. We'd come home. Mom would check us for ticks and make sure that we didn't have any bug bites. That she had to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, no cell phones, obviously. So
yeah.
My mother had two friends with boys that somehow or another, they were able to keep track of us.
Wow.
But we were gone all day long.
It sounds amazing.
It was amazing.
Did you recognize that at the time as being special? I'm always, when someone grows up in a unique situation like that, I always wonder if at the time they have any appreciation for the fact of how special that is.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Until my dad decided to open up his own restaurant
uh-huh.
in 1979 in Atlanta, Georgia. And we left that home in the woods that was adjacent to the resort that he was an executive chef of, mm-hmm. food and beverage manager.
And that's a whole other double life.
We had a second story apartment looking over 85 Expressway in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
And that's when it hit my brother and I. It was like,
hell,
what is this
nightmare.
Life? What is this life?
Yeah.
What life did we have? And what are we doing now living on top of an expressway?
That must have been an awful adjustment.
In an attic, by the way.
Was it an awful adjustment?
It wasn't fun.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say awful just because. From a young boy, I just grew up always
adapting.
Nothing's awful.
Yeah.
Nothing's awful for
kids
me.
Kids can absorb a
you
lot
just
of
have to
adaption.
Adapt.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
all about adaption.
Yep.
So, you know, that probably taught me also to always have a positive outlook on life because you got to make the most of whatever you're dealt with.
Yeah.
And my dad certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a wonderful job. And eventually things, you know, for us got into a better place. And thankfully, you know, we got away from that apartment over the expressway, but I do know what it's all about.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about the food culture in your family.
So the food culture in the family is huge, huge. In a Greek household and in ours being in the restaurant business, every single moment of the day is what about food? What are we going to have for breakfast tomorrow? Then you have breakfast. What are we going to have for lunch? After lunch is, do you want to have anything for snack in between? Then it's about dinner, and then after dinner, you know, we critique, we think about what we ate, mm-hmm. and then it's start all over again.
And how much of a presence was the Greek culinary canon? Was it first of all, what was Greek spoken in your family here in the States?
Greek was spoken by my mother and father
and their
when
parent.
They were arguing in front of us so that we didn't know what they were talking about.
So you
about.
Don't speak – do you speak it?
I speak a little bit.
A little bit.
Yes.
Can you understand it better than you can speak it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I got it.
So – you know, to answer your question, you know, where was the Greek heritage yeah. come into my life, living yeah. out in the woods of Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri? Well, it happened as soon as I moved to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Because in that apartment on the expressway, we were 1 mile from the Greek Orthodox Cathedral.
Okay.
So every Sunday, I'm now surrounded by people with weird names like me. And not only that, but you stay after church,
mm-hmm.
and you have Greek cookies, mm-hmm. and you have Greek pastry, mm-hmm. and you have Greek coffee, and sometimes you have savory, you have pies, and you have salads, and you kind of stay, and every Sunday is sort of this huge Greek experience. I actually feel like part of the reason why Greek church is more popular here in the States than it is in Greece is because we're trying to keep our culture.
100%.
And we're trying to keep it alive, and the best way to do it is, you know, through the church and community after church.
And through food.
And through food.
I mean, completely, you found the food through the church, right?
But
independently, food is very often something that immigrants do to... I grew up with a Cuban stepmother.
There you
and
go.
And that was like... I used to refer to it... Once in an article I wrote about her, I referred to it as their kind of life raft. You know, that was the thing that they still had that they could conjure up on a half hour's notice that took them home.
Yes. And so at the same time that I've moved to Atlanta and I'm a mile away from this church, my grandmother moved in with us.
Mm. And because course, she had gotten frail or sick.
We lost my papu, mm-hmm. which is how we say grandfather, about 2 years before we moved to Atlanta.
Okay.
My papu had passed away.
Yep.
So my yaya was living all alone. And when we moved to Atlanta, we took her in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when the Greek heritage really became alive because she spoke Greek. She barely spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
She was going to the grocery store every single day.
The Greek is coming from inside the house.
Oh, yes. And she's coming home and she is cooking. And yeah. my yaya was a cooking machine. She made her own breads.
Got it.
Pastry.
How old is this savory. Woman at this point? She 80s?
She had to be in her 70s.
70s, but could still spend a whole day in this kitchen. And
there are things in this book that if anybody thinks are, you know, there's
fabulous.
No way I can.
Yeah.
There's no way I could make that. Well, my 75-year-old, you know, yaya or my mm-hmm. aunts in Greece were all making this food.
Okay.
So doing all the heavy lifting, everything. So
did you feel at all? I'm just curious because we had J.J. Johnson was on not long ago, and he was talking about the African diaspora, right? And
okay.
he was talking about when he where did he I forget where he finally went. But when he finally went there, the smells and the taste, it all sort of. He connected to it almost on a primal level, right? Do you connect to Greek food in that way, even
Absolutely.
Though you were born here in the States?
Absolutely.
You feel like it filled in a part of your DNA?
It fills in part of my heritage.
It does.
Absolutely.
On almost just an animal instinctive level.
Oh, yeah. The smell of oregano.
Yeah.
The sight of
yeah.
lemons and olives and yeah. olive oil.
These things
I
mean,
when I see that, I don't think I see it like other people see it in the States that aren't connected to their heritage.
You feel almost a kinship with it.
Automatically.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating?
I love it. It's who we are.
Yeah. You can't explain it, really.
No.
Yeah.
You just
I don't think you can. I've never seen it explained. Okay. So you – well, let's quickly, because it is in the book, tell the TCBY story.
So,
which is the story of how you ended up in a restaurant.
Absolutely. So I grew up with my father. He former executive chef, hard worker, 7 days a week. When we lived in Lake Ozark, Missouri, we come to Atlanta and he's creating his empire. And he's got about 3 or 4 restaurants at this point. I'm 15. And as soon as I turn 15, it's in December. And we come around the corner. He says, son, you need to start thinking about what you want to do for a job. And I'm going to give you 1 week to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay, got to do it. Dad said, got to do it. So leaves me. He goes to work. 1 week later, sure enough, just like he said he would, what do you want to do? I had the best answer in the world. I had thought about it, talked about it with my friends. I wanted to work the counter at the TCBY Yogurt.
Right, which stands for people. Is it still around? I don't even know. But it stands for the country's best yogurt. That's right. It was a chain. We don't have them in New York. I grew up in Miami. They were
so we have them down south, obviously.
Yeah.
And the idea was that I'd be pumping the yogurt. All the girls at the time used to like to go to TCBY. Yeah, so there's going to be. I had my summer set. Knew exactly what I'd do. My friends were going to come over. I was going to give them the hookups, and I was
eat all the yogurt you wanted.
Girls, yeah. And then Dad pulled the chain. He heard that. And he said, to hell you're not. And until you know what you want to do in life, you're going to come work for me. And so there I am now, working at Panos and Paul's a couple of weeks later. And it's in Atlanta. This is the premier restaurant for fine dining. And so every night was a Saturday night. Mm-hmm. So the capacity for the restaurant, we could do 300 covers. And he was doing that every single night. And so my first job was being thrown in the fire and fine dining at age 15, when most of the line cooks were all in their early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's and the TCBY yogurt story.
That's a sink or swim moment, right?
I mean,
you were in the family, but where did you fall in on the sink or swim scale?
It was huge mistakes. You know, they taught me how to shuck oysters. The chef said, okay, I'm going to need you to do 12. I said, okay. Service comes around. The first order comes up. It was for a dozen oysters. And there they were. And they were done. They were beautiful, the whole nine yards. The next order comes in. I didn't have any. And the chef wanted to know where they were. And I said, well, you know, you told me to do 12. And he said, no, I made 12 orders. The restaurant was so busy that, you know, right before service, we were able to just get ahead and open some up because they knew in the first 15 minutes we were going to sell them.
Right.
So little mistakes that were big mistakes.
Yeah.
I was also working out all the time, so I would come in and my arms were tired. And, you know, I couldn't put my weight on, like, carrying trays or Lexons, and I was slow. And so the speed wasn't there. They put me on the crepe station. I'm burning all my fingers off. The girl that was doing chocolate crepes could do a rotation of 9 pans.
Wow.
So that she could make 36 crepes in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Amazing.
And
up in that kind of, like, a lot of people go see that kind of stuff early on, and that's just like, that's it. Game over.
Right. So my rotation was about 3 pans.
Right.
And messing up 1 out of 3 every so often and taking forever to do them. So what I learned immediately was I was way too green to be in that restaurant, but I didn't know it. I had those kind of struggles to get over with, but I did. And what because I was an athlete and I had been playing sports all throughout the year, I became very competitive.
Mm.
And competitive with myself. Every single day that I went to work, I wanted to be better than the day before.
What was your sport?
I played 10 years of football, 10 years of basketball.
Team stuff.
I wrestled for 6 years, which is not
individual, but team. Yeah.
And then I played baseball 6 years, and I ran track for about 6 years. So
mix of individual and team.
A mix.
Yeah. This comes up a lot on the show. I think both of those in different ways, right, suit someone headed for the kitchen.
Absolutely.
The individual stuff, because stamina, training, repetitive, muscle memory, all that. And then the team thing is really obvious.
Big time. And you learn sense of urgency through sports, so you apply it right away with a restaurant kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
All you do in sports is keep going over and over your plays or your moves, whatever it is that you're doing. So repetitiveness is key.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are things that I knew were going to get me over the top.
Yeah.
And by the end of the first summer of working, I wound up as good as anybody else on my particular station.
Now, what was your conception at that? Your dad was a chef. There's the, you know, this period of time, the whole idea of what a chef was, and certainly in this country, is changing quickly, right? Chefs are becoming known. It's going from sort of this blue-collar profession to some people are starting to get famous. You know, people aren't just cranking out you know, the classics. People are starting to create these signature dishes, right?
Right, yeah.
Were you aware of all, like, what was a chef to you at that point? And as you start thinking about maybe sticking your toe in the water in this profession, how are you thinking about what a chef is? Does that question make sense? Like, were you thinking of it more the old way or more kind of the new way?
Well, when I first started working, learning how to cook was the first step.
Mm-hmm.
Learning how to be a chef was beyond my imagination.
It was.
However, living with my father, who is, you know, this great restaurateur, knowing that he started out as a chef, being in the kitchen and being part of his system,
yeah,
and how he wants the cooks to work and how he wants us to perform, I have been hearing all his life lessons since I was a young child.
Yeah.
So it was for me implementation.
Yeah.
Of his sort of philosophy,
mm-hmm.
philosophy on life, philosophy on work, work ethic, pride, all the things that he ever talked about at home existed in his kitchen.
And you internalized all that stuff.
All of it. And yeah. I also knew it was the expectation of me.
Right.
So I was able to apply it. And yes, you know, I had my fumbles in the beginning that cost a lot of time or product, but I had to get over them quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to.
Yeah.
And because I was able to, and because I could see I was actually good at cooking, because some people are very good at cooking in a kitchen because they have natural talent, and then some people aren't.
Yeah.
They can still cook at home, but they don't have to be in the business.
Yeah.
And I found my passion. And that summer was huge for me because it wound up that I didn't need or want to do anything else in life.
Mm. You knew it already. You knew it.
I did.
Was there a moment you looked to when it clicked? Do you remember?
Yeah, just, you knew, having my first great service.
Okay. And you love that feeling.
I love that
when feeling. You walked out after that, that it was it. Like that
when
was
I finally
mic
had
drop.
My first
yeah.
great service.
Yeah.
It was the best feeling in the world.
Because you knew you could it was attainable.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then I couldn't wait to get back into work to go do it again.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So where was your family in all that? When you decide to pursue this, right? Most people I know, especially from this time we're talking about, who had family in the business, their family would discourage them from getting into it. Where did your family fall in on this?
It goes back to my Greek heritage. Being a chef is part of being a Greek American who is connected to food, and all we do all day long is cook, 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 cook,
yeah.
cook. So why not make it a profession? It's
mm-hmm.
actually a very natural profession for Greek Americans and people who live in Greece.
Awesome.
So how hospitality?
Do you, yeah,
if you
sure.
think about it,
yeah.
you know the word in itself. Is very, very ethnic and very Greek. So
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's something that's very natural.
Yeah. So how do you decide to pursue this, and what do you do?
Well, I'm still a big athlete in
mm-hmm.
my high school years. So really it became part of my rotation. Loved playing football, loved wrestling, playing basketball for church, and track and baseball in the spring. And I loved cooking. So it just became part of the natural progression. And then once I got to college, I'm not playing sports. So I wind up cooking, working about 40 hours a week because I always loved, you know, being in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I had this little thing called classes that I had to do. So
How were you with school?
Excuse me?
How were you as a student?
I was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
I was okay. I was totally into cooking. It's
yeah.
what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I told my father straight out of high school I wanted to go to the Culinary Institute of America. But because my mother and father did not go to college, they wanted me to go to college.
Okay.
And they wanted me to get a diploma.
Uh-huh.
So it was sort of like, okay, I'm going to go to college. I wanted to go to the Culinary Institute of America. But I'm going to do college. But I'm going to cook while I'm at college.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have fun cooking, living life, living that lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
and doing this thing called school. So
yeah.
I was okay with my grades. If it was related at all, like yeah. I graduated from Florida International University with a hospitality management degree.
Yep.
So everything that was related in college to the profession, I took very seriously.
So here's a question. That detail's in the book.
Yes.
Right? I would think that maybe for you, but definitely for a lot of people, there's this whole thing about culinary school and whether or not you need it, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone agrees that you don't get everything you need in culinary school. That's why they have externships, right?
Correct.
It's not the same as a real working kitchen, right? I would think in hindsight, and this is a question, but I'm kind of saying it as a statement, but I would think in hindsight that degree may have actually been ultimately more useful to you than if you had than going to cooking school.
Correct.
Because you can learn to cook. You had already started learning to cook.
Right. You know, going most kids or even career changers that go to culinary schools haven't cooked in restaurants for longer than a year.
Right. There's a 1 or 2 year, I think, requirement at the CIA.
Some people haven't figured out whether it's for them or not.
Right.
And that's the biggest mistake that a lot of these kids and career changers are doing.
Yeah.
So for me, I was lucky that I had cooked since I was 15 till I graduated from college, 22, and then wanted to go to culinary school. And it still made sense to do it.
Yeah.
Because Culinary Institute of America is one of the best in the world. And you're going to learn when you go there. The best thing that happened to me was I'm there absorbing the best of the best that I could get from them, whereas a lot of people who were there were taking notes on every word and breath the instructors were taking.
Right.
They were nervous. They couldn't get it. They didn't understand.
Yeah.
And it was par for the course because they didn't have the experience. So culinary school is very important.
Yeah. You believe in it.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's interesting.
And I still see the difference between those who made the commitment to culinary schools and those who did not. Uh-huh. Those who did not sometimes wind up taking being in your kitchen for granted.
That's interesting. How do you mean that?
Well, you have your rules in the kitchen, your order in the kitchen, the way you want people to behave and work. You have your recipes, the importance of following the recipes, consistency, understanding that consistency is going to make your restaurant great,
yes,
or fail.
Uh-huh.
Your concept has to be great as well and understood in order for the consistency to work.
Yeah.
And all these things are taught in culinary school. And so some of the kids off the streets that come in, I have to put extra time and work.
They don't have the bird's eye view.
That's right.
Right.
And it's fine. Some of my favorite people never went to culinary school, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
It's just that I had to be more of a dad to them than I needed to with the ones that did.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's always a fascinating conversation. I mean the example I always give is, you know, you look at Thomas Keller and you look at Jonathan Waxman, right?
Right.
Guess which one went to cooking school and which one didn't?
Exactly.
You know, Waxman went to cooking school.
Right.
Keller didn't.
He didn't. But
that's a fascinating thing. But that is a fascinating counterintuitive example.
It is very fascinating. And at the same time, too, you know, Thomas wound up having an incredible mentor.
Oh, yeah. Who was an instructor at the Culinary Institute.
And so the point of, like, what I'm saying, you know, I just had to be – I have to be a bigger dad in that scenario. And he had one, too.
Yes.
And, you know, really take somebody under your wing and teach them everything they possibly need to know.
Yeah. And he did go and sneak classes in once in a while.
And from what I know too as well, he is pretty well connected now with the Culinary Institute of America.
Oh my gosh, he's like their favorite son or stepson. I don't know what you call it if you didn't go there.
I know. He is.
So okay, hopefully we'll remember to say this in the intro. You're on a whirlwind trip. We have limited time, so I just mentioned Thomas. You go on to work for three of the most important, definitely in this country, but really in the world, they're all 3-star Michelin chefs. You go on to work for Eric Rappaire. And I just have to say, the lunch that you did while you were in town, which was a media lunch, was at Le Bernardin and the Salon, which I'd never been up to. It was, first of all, the most elegant space. The staff was incredible. The food, really, I mean, I'm telling you, everybody, Carolyn's here, who was at the table. people were, I mean, just loving every bite of it. It was an amazing lunch. But you worked for Eric, you worked for Jean-Georges Van Richten, and you worked for Thomas Keller out in Napa, not in New York.
Yes.
Can you just give a little thumbnail of sort of the key thing that you sort of took from each of them?
Absolutely. Coming out to take a look at Culinary Institute of America and trying to develop my externship, where I'm going to go cook. At that point in time, Gilbert Lacoz had a restaurant, Brasserie Lacoz, in Atlanta, Georgia. So we knew of him. Of course, my father is a huge fan of Le Bernardin. And so it was always something that I wanted to do prior to cooking school.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping that I could get in and do that. Well, Gilbert passed away, and then Eric took over. And, you know, when Eric Repair took over Le Bernardin, he had to prove to the world that he could maintain those four stars, which at that point in time, New York Times four stars was the highest, you know, accolade.
Yes, and Michelin wasn't here
Michelin
in New York
wasn't
yet.
Here.
So that was the gold standard.
Yeah, so yeah. So I'm at culinary school, and, you know, we sort of speak and interview, and I'm going to work at Le Bernardin. But by the time my externship is coming up, he had gotten those four stars. Now everybody's coming to Le Bernardin again and again and again, and Chef Eric and the staff, we all have to prove that we can keep that we were worthy of the four stars, because now everybody's coming. Everything had to be ultra perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So what I learned working at Le Bernardin was what it was like to work in one of the best restaurants, not only in the world but in New York City. And I learned the pace.
Mm.
I learned the importance of attention to detail, flavor, taste. I learned the most incredible stocks from seafood and sauces derived from those stocks.
Mm-hmm.
I could spend almost this whole entire podcast talking about what I learned at Le Bernardin. But I have to tell you, as a chef, Eric Repairet taught that it is important from the time you step into the restaurant to the time you leave to care about every single ingredient, every single step, every single motion, your time from A to Z when you walk in that door.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with Chris Muller, who is still there, and I was happy to work with yesterday.
Officially chef de cuisine. What's his title?
You know, I don't know what his title is.
But it's in that realm. It's in the realm of CDC.
Right.
Yeah.
Le Bernardin is so big these days. They have 160 employees because they have the wine bar. They've got the banquets upstairs, so on and so forth. So Chris is running the restaurants underneath Eric Repairet.
It's almost like a culinary chief of operations.
Yeah.
In a way.
I mean, it's pretty intense. Yeah. So, but yeah, learning that from Eric Repairet was amazing. And then on top of it, learning anything and everything that I've ever wanted to do with seafood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from raw preparations to the gently cooked, to poaching, shallow poaching, sautéing, you name it.
Yeah.
We did it at Le Bernardin, and they still do, and they're the best at it.
Yep.
So I learned the best of the best when it came to seafood. When I was done at Le Bernardin, you know, I was coming up, I asked Chef Eric, I was like, hey, listen, you know, in 6 months, you know, I'd worked every position in the restaurant. So in 6 months, what do you think I should do? And he says, well, he goes, you know, I think you should go work for Jean-Georges Van Richten. And if I were to back up and say that again, there is a time where I had cooked every position in the restaurant at Le Bernardin.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get into meat cookery. So I asked Chef Eric, I gave him a 6-month notice, and I asked him where I should work. And he said, you should go work for Jean-Georges Van Richten. And I listened.
Right. Can I sound like a grumpy old guy now?
Sure.
You could too. 6 months notice.
That's
go ahead.
Right. That's what happened.
I don't need to say anymore.
When you're born from a
there are people listening to this podcast who are like, 6 months notice.
Yes, 6 months.
You can't
notice.
Just send a text?
That's called respect. That's called
that's
respect.
The old way.
That's the old way.
Yeah, that's how it used to work in New York. Yeah.
My father said that he's always raised me to say that a 4-week notice is a pot washer notice.
So.
Yes,
okay.
6 months. And so I had time to plan.
Yeah.
And I interviewed with Jean-Georges. I interviewed with Daniel Belude. And Daniel offered me a poissonnier, which is the fish station.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean-Georges offered me meat station. And funny story is when I'm getting a phone call from Danielle after I accepted with Jean-Georges, he says, hey, Pano, what have you decided to do? And I said, well, chef, I said, with all due respect, I'm going to go cook for Jean-Georges Van Gerecht and on the meat station. And he said, son of a bitch. He goes, I cannot do that. But in 3 months, I can do that. And I said to myself, I can't take that chance. I was like, right. I love Danielle's food, and I'm a huge fan of him. And I wish somehow or another I could have had a fourth chef to work for, and it would have been Danielle Belud. And wound up going to Jean-Georges.
Yeah.
Step on the day one, I'm cooking at Jean-Georges, and the guy who's training me is the coolest guy I've ever met in the kitchen, practically, and his name was Wiley Dufresne. So Wiley was...
I'm not explaining who that is. People right. can look it up if you don't know.
Go look it up. So Wiley was a sous chef for Jean-Georges. He cooked for him for 5 years, I believe.
Yeah, he was sort of a favorite son. I know Jean-Georges like set him up overseas and for stages. And
rightfully so. Yeah. I mean, Wiley's just one of the best guys you could ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
And Wiley took me under his wing, taught me all the Jean-Georges classics and the jus, and talked to me about every element of cooking the way that Jean-Georges does. I couldn't have had a better trainer. And I stayed at Jean-Georges for about 2 years. I had previously been at Le Bernardin for 3. And I cooked meat. And Jean-Georges was amazing. Mm-hmm. He taught me to treat all meats the way that they should be, according to their whether how lean they were, how fatty they were, how much they could handle heat, not handle heat and just gently be cooked. I mean, it was amazing the things that we did.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And I was doing game birds with him. They were ranging from partridge to quail to squab to duck to pheasant. I was learning how to cook them on a rotisserie, French rotisserie. How to deal with the fat level of the duck breast in a cold pan. Literally, you get your pan off the shelf, you put your duck breast in, then you put it on a flat top. Things like that I never saw.
I love how you're pantomiming. That's when you know someone was at a station a long time.
That's right. Yeah.
Right? You could probably walk me right now through certain dishes that you did way back then.
Oh, I absolutely.
Yeah, this goes in, this goes in. Wait till it sizzles, then that, right? You could do that.
The lessons I learned at Jean-Georges were valuable for meat cookery. It was amazing. I happened to have a friend that was getting married out in the West Coast. I'd already told Jean-Georges that I was thinking of a notice. I'd worked for him, like I said, for about a year and a half. And so I gave him a good 4.5 month notice. And met Thomas Keller while my friend was getting married. And he took a lot of time. It was a great interview. We were together for like 30, 45 minutes.
What year are we in here, roughly?
We're in year 2000.
Okay.
I met Eric Siebold on the interview, and he was part of the reason. He's a great chef.
Eric had been a chef. I think Eric came up in our interview with Tim Hollingsworth, but Eric was a chef there, and then he moved on to the D.C. area.
Yes.
Yeah, where I believe he still is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Eric's incredible, incredible chef, but incredible cook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they all are. So, I noticed right off the bat, I mean, you're in the French Laundry, and the consistency is amazing. And, the attention to detail, the tasting menu, and how it's performed, it's over the top.
I mean, the fact that they write a new one every day.
Right. I mean, on my stage, while I interview and I stage and I just see this performance, it was a performance. It was like going to the ballet. It was.
Yeah. I don't know if people know this. I've been lucky. I did a book about the Bocuse d'Or the year that they took over, the year Tim Hollingsworth went. So I got to observe a lot at the Laundry. At the end of the night, after putting out 3-star Michelin food, the cooks, I assume it was this way when you were there.
Yeah.
They pull stools up around the stoves in the kitchen. Whatever wine bottles are left, they put that in the middle, and they sit there and they drink wine and they go over the list of the inventory.
Yeah,
and the cooks, along with whoever is expediting that night, write the menu for the next day. And some of the dishes, you mentioned this in passing in the book, but some of the dishes are new compositions that are being created through the guys just kind of spitballing around the stoves at 1 a.m.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
You know, the biggest thing is know your inventory.
Yeah.
If we don't have it and there's a way of getting it, then we'll get it.
Yeah.
I jumped right in off the bat getting into that concept, you know, sitting around with Chef or Eric Zeeble and Grant Ackett at the time was at the restaurant too as a sous chef, and couldn't be surrounded by better people to teach me and let my sort of creative juices flow.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was nothing better than knowing that when I left that little meeting at 1 a.m, sometimes 2, that those 3 or 4 recipes that we dreamt up right there at the table, we're going to be on the menu the next day. So you can't get back. You can't wait to get back in at 10 a.m. so you can get going on them.
Right.
And that's the what Thomas brought to the table for me, that empowerment that he gave his staff to create, to stay within his format and create, is the most powerful element that I learned.
It's weird. When I think about it, I think of like Starfleet. You know, I think of like, right, or an academy. It's amazing. Because there's all these young people at this revered restaurant, and Thomas talks about this openly. He's not there expediting. I mean, the chef de cuisine is making the call, and it's incredible, the faith in the team.
Yeah.
You know,
the faith in the team is huge. Of course, while I was there, I mean, the most beautiful thing about my 3 experiences that I love is that I was there at a really good time where every night Eric Rappert was there running the pass.
Yeah.
Same thing with Jean-Georges and the same thing with
and
Thomas
And you were
Keller.
With Keller before Per Se, yeah, which didn't come along
Per Se until 2004.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I want to – hopefully I'll remember to say this in the intro. You're on a whirlwind, right? So you're going to have to stop talking soon. But I want to talk briefly about the book. First of all, I need to just ask you quickly. I am struck – Thomas wrote the intro to your book. Eric hosted this lunch that you and your team came up and cooked yesterday.
Yes.
You've maintained really good relationships. A lot of people are on good terms with people they've worked for, but not to the point where you could get a forward from Keller, or you could get, you know, the salon at Le Bernardin. It seems to me you must invest time. I mean, you must nurture these relationships. You're pretty far out from having worked for these people.
Yes. I mean, it's been a while since I've worked for all of them.
Yeah.
I mean,
a long time.
I have a great relationship with all 3 of them.
Yeah.
With Thomas, we have a good sort of staying in touch, texting, you know, celebrating the holiday type relationship. With Eric, it's still a great mentor relationship where, you know, if I'm not asking Thomas for it, I'll ask Eric for some advice. Jean-Georges, when I come in town, I always make it a point to see him over at the Trump. When I do, you know, we catch up that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when this book came out and I'm wanting to do what it takes so people can learn about it, you know, my mentors have really stood up to the plate.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Yeah, it's just a great relationship that I've had.
Okay, so we talked about how beautiful the book is. The structure of this book is unusual.
Yes.
I mean, I'll just say this. There's a subsection on octopus.
Right.
That's a bold move. I love octopus. Love. I think a lot of people do. I think when you say here, do not fear the octopus, you mean cooking it.
Yes.
Yeah, which a lot of people find more intimidating than it actually is. But talk to me. It's mezze, entrees, desserts, and then within those... So mezze, spreads, vegetarian, octopus, seafood, phyllo pastries, right?
Yes.
So this tracks what you see as the categories of Greek food.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when I got together with Rizzoli,
yeah,
and we were putting together the sort of chapter concept of the book,
mm-hmm,
they were surprised that I wanted to spend 50% of the recipes on appetizers, which are called mezze.
Mm-hmm.
And won them over with talking about the culture of sharing. And they totally understood, and they said, you know what? This is not normal for us, but it makes total sense for this book.
Yeah.
We'll back you on that. And so they did. And then I told them, I said, we're going to do your typical vegetarian seafood and meat appetizers, and the same thing with the entrees. I said, but there's, you know, in my heart, in my heritage and everything that I'm about, you know, we've got to have a a chapter on octopus so that people can learn how to cook it. All my relatives cook it in Greece. Yeah. It's like cooking, you know, chicken or right. steak. And the same thing goes for avgolimonos, because everybody just knows the avgolimonos soup, but there are so many different preparations we're raised with. So I want an avgolimono chapter.
Meaning what?
Egg lemon.
Egg emulsion. And lemon, that combination.
It's, yes, yep. yes. And then I wanted to have a chapter on the pies, because the little savory Greek pies, they're the most delicious things in the world, and they're so easy to make. So we had to make a chapter out of that, too,
right.
as well.
And that's another one, right? People probably know spanakopita.
That's right, spanakopita.
But what else do they know?
Well, right. there's the cheese pies, right. the spinach pie. Yeah. We have in the book a lamb pie.
Yeah.
You know, we have a salmon and
I had one
pie.
For lunch yesterday.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, pies are an important part of the culture, and I want to dedicate a chapter. So I came up with these sub-chapters, and Rizzoli loved it. And so it became part of the book. Also, one of the most important sub-chapters to me in the book is the wine chapter.
Mm.
When I opened up Kima, my cousin Sophia had come from Greece to educate people on Greek wines.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't a salesperson. She wasn't working on commission. Her job was to teach people in North America about Greek wine. She represented about 20 wineries.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to put together the menu for Kima, and she did the wine menu for Kima.
Mm.
So we paired up together.
Yep.
We've done many events around the country for years and years and years. So what I do know, and I firmly believe, is Sophia's work in the early 2000s created a trend that lasts about 5 to 6 years for Greek wines. And everybody was writing up about the Greek wines, learning about the Greek wines. And because of that, a lot of Greek chefs that were doing Greek food very well were able to tag along the ride. And what I always knew was that if I did a book, I was going to pay huge respects to Greek wine, because that trend helped my restaurant and helped many others that were doing Greek restaurants around the country as well, too.
That's
so
great.
I'm proud that we have this great chapter on the back part of the book. Each recipe is paired with a Greek grape.
Mm-hmm.
And these beautiful Greek grapes, ancient grapes, give you a chance to try something different than Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and all the wine grapes that you've had before. They have great flavor profiles themselves. So this book also, in its own way, is a food and wine book.
Well, I'll just say again, there were two wine flights that accompanied the luncheon
yes.
that you guys put on. And she was there introducing them. And such a nice – I mean, you could just tell.
Sophia's amazing.
She's radiant.
Yes.
She radiates niceness and intelligence and elegance. And the wines were – same for the wines. I'll apply all those adjectives to the wines. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's a stunning book. I love the structure. And as you said, you know, it is interesting because I was eating the food at the lunch yesterday. And in that setting, especially, and on that, you know, on the serveware that they use there, and your plating technique is, you know, and your team, obviously, it's restaurant caliber. But it isn't terribly complicated food. I mean, it's not. It is doable. When I saw some of this stuff come out, it didn't, because it looks so pretty, I didn't immediately get that. But as I started eating through it, I did. And then looking at the book, you know, I made a point of looking at the recipes for the dishes we had at the lunch, and I was almost stunned. I mean, this really is doable, and you really do take a food that people probably know in a very glancing way and give them, you know, without being preachy or textbooky about it.
Right.
Give them a very sort of romanticized, I think, lesson in it. And a very, you know, I love the structure. I'm a big structure person when I work on cookbooks. I think structure is absolutely crucial. And usually the best way to do a book is soups, pastas, salads, you know, fish, poultry, meat. That usually is right. But the way you came at this, I think, I just thought it was great. I mean, I learned a lot spending some time with it.
One of the other great relationships that came from the book was doing this with Jane Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
And she's done many works herself, books, Food and Wine magazine. I think she stepped in as editors before. And so at the end of the day, she kept all these recipes on track. She tested every single one and made sure that these could work at home. She's a stickler for structure.
Yeah.
And she's a stickler for making sure that everything is going to work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I big thanks to Jane Siegel for the writer, the co-writer with me.
Well, as someone who's collaborated on more than 24 cookbooks, I think it's really sweet that you gave your collaborator the last word because you got to go. Okay, Pano, great to meet you. Great to have had your food. The book is Modern Greek Cooking, 100 Recipes for Mezze, Entrees, and Desserts. I can't recommend it highly enough, and it was great to meet you. I hope we'll get to see each other again.
Yes.
Thank you. And that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed meeting Naomi Pomeroy and Pano Karatsis. I did. And I want to thank, as always, our engineer, Vitor, for splicing these things together, for doing whatever extra work it took to get this episode up and to get the many episodes I'm trying to get up on the air right now, up on the air. Thank you very much, Vitor. Thank you, Matt, another engineer at Heritage, if you contributed to this effort, as I'm told you may have. Thank you to Kat Johnson for her assistance in making all this happen. Kat's another member of the Heritage Radio Network team. Caitlin, who has not been doing these intros with me because I'm just trying to get them done and up. We'll have you back on the show soon, Kate, but thanks for being a willing co-conspirator. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here really soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.